Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I bring back John Lorden so we can talk about a few different things in this show, including the floating feet that keep showing up in British Columbia, and one very strange disappearance people are particularly interested in. So we're going to get into that stuff and some other stuff on the side here and there, because it is Where Did the Road Go? And you can find John Lorden at Lorden Arts YouTube channel. It's a fantastic channel. Very down to earth, very in detail. So if you're interested in missing people and stuff like that, he's the one to check out. He has just a wealth of stuff up there, does like 5 shows a week or something like that. It's pretty awesome. And it's always good to have him on the show. All right. Other stuff. We did just update the website. It might still be a little glitchy in spots. I'm going to work it out over hopefully the next week. So wheredidtheroadgo.com, of course, is the site. And we just kind of changed the template around. And I have to thank John Chuter of Deprogrammed Radio. Without him, this show wouldn't be what it is, period. And he's given me so much website help. I used to design websites in the very basic, you know, HTML style, and he got me into Joomla. And he's still way more of an expert at it than I am, so he helped me change the theme over. And I think it's a much better theme for the website. So check out Deprogrammed Radio. And if you need web stuff, talk to John. He's amazing. All right. If you want to help out the show, become a patron. You know, rate us on iTunes, etc., etc. All that can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And here we go. Here's my conversation with John Lorden.
So, John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Soraya. Good to be talking to you again. It's been too long.
Yeah, apparently it's been a year. Time gets away from me. So we're going to see how much stuff we can cover in this show. There's been a few things we were talking about. I did have a question for you from some listeners.
Sure.
They were interested to know what your stance on like the paranormal and stuff was.
You know, it's one of those things where I come into situations with an open mind, and I want to be shown compelling information that I can use to make my own decisions. So when it comes to the paranormal, I've had experiences in my life that I can't explain. I cannot write off that there are things much bigger than this world at play that I don't understand. With that being said, I'm also looking for more than just stories from people that are hard to support or refute, because they ultimately just come down to words, you know, coming out of someone's mouth. So I'm looking for more. I know I heard in a recent podcast of yours where someone was being critical of photo analysis, mm-hmm. and talking about how hard it is to make anything out of photo analysis anymore, because ultimately it comes down to, yeah, there's something weird in that picture, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that is a UFO flying above Arizona.
Right. It doesn't tell us what it is.
Exactly. Exactly. But I'll take it, you know. Start with the story. Tell me whatever the people are talking about. And then I want to look beyond that and look for information that either supports or refutes that story. So I'm open. I have to say that over the course of doing my YouTube channel at Lorden Arts, I feel like I've become more critical of those stories, because in a lot of cases, when I look into the information, it really boils down to people's personal accounts. And I want video, I want audio, I want pictures, I want other people that might have witnessed it. You know, it's been an interesting journey for me, because I feel ultimately like I am more skeptical than I used to be, but I'm trying to not be lazy about it and let that become a default position. Every case I look into, I start with an open and clear mind, as clear as I can get it. I try to really check my biases as I'm going through the investigation process. And when I come out to a conclusion, Ultimately, it's not a hard conclusion. You know, I think that is part of the great thing about YouTube in particular and ongoing shows like you and I both have. If we come to the end of an episode, we can say, here's where I'm at with this particular episode, with the information that I reviewed, this is the conclusion that I believe is most likely. But that's the great thing about YouTube and that comment section right below that video. Then it's up to the audience to feed in more information. And I believe people that are really looking for that connection, looking for that ongoing dialogue, which I believe you're one of these types as well, you know, goes through that. And then we learn. You know, we might hear about angles that we didn't hear about before. We could be sent articles that we didn't read before. And that's the great thing that I like about doing my channel is I can always come back to a topic and say, you know what, this is part two on that episode. And you guys have brought me a bunch of new information. And maybe now I'm in a completely different position than I started.
Yeah. Yeah. I think anytime you get set on, okay, I understand what's happening. I know the answers, even if you can't prove it. That's the point where you stop being able to move forward.
Yes. Yeah. You have to, I've always said I reserve the right to be wrong.
Yeah.
Because, it's weird. I think I see a lot in our modern culture that people don't like to use that right. People like to be right at the expense of everything else and just, oh, I knew it. I knew it right from the start. I don't need that. What I would prefer is, hey, there's new information that came in and what I thought before was not necessarily, the end of this story and let's continue learning about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And unless you have verifiable fact to put it to rest, you can't really.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's different because I also review true crime and, you know, at some point in some of those cases, you know, if it's a missing persons case and ultimately they find the remains, then we have some part of an answer.
Yeah.
If that person goes to trial and, you know, a judge and jury convict someone, I mean, there are certain places where true crime stories really can hit a finite end.
Yes.
But when it comes to stories of the paranormal, that is hardly the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless it turns out that the person was hoaxing things.
That's true. That's true. But I don't know, even in those cases, how many of you out there still believe in crop circles?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about crop circles is, first of all, so the initial ones probably were not hoaxed.
Right.
You know, the people who were claiming to hoax them all couldn't have done all the ones they were claiming to do in the time period. But also, you know, when they were asked where they came up with the idea, they pointed to crop circles. You know, it's kind of like, okay, so there's a phenomena that makes these things swirl like this.
Right, right. But just to make the point that even hoaxes aren't always the end of a paranormal experience.
It's funny when you hear the people who are hoaxing them say, we had weird experiences while we were doing them.
Right.
The universe is a strange place.
Yep. Someone's got to look into it and try to make sense out of it.
Right. So let's talk about you did a video, I would say probably within the last month on a subject I've always found really curious. And this is the feet that keep washing up on the, is it British Columbia?
Yeah. The Salish Sea. It's a channel of water that runs kind of, just on the southern edge of British Columbia in Canada and right above Washington. And yeah, the floating feet mystery is, what we called it.
Mm-hmm.
Basically since 2007, there have been several detached human feet that have been found around the coasts of that Salish Sea. And did I say seven? I meant several. They've up to this point, there's actually been 16 feet found.
Oh, that's it? I thought it was more for some reason.
Yeah, no, it's only 16. And there's all kinds of different theories. You know, of course, when it first started happening, the police really started looking into the possibility that there might be something going on potentially. I mean, they didn't come right out and say serial killer, but they were investigating it very, very hard and very rapidly. But the feet literally kept popping up on both sides of this water channel. And, yeah, I mean, over the course of, I think 5-6 years, you have 16 feet. And you literally have situations where it's like people go to the beach, they're hanging out on the rocks, they go walking around and they see a shoe and they go look inside the shoe, and inside the shoe is a sock, and they look inside the sock, and inside the sock you have human remains.
And so were there any cases of this reported before 2007?
You know, that's a really good question. I looked for other cases, because the explanation for this, hit a couple of strange points. One of the things is in 10 of these 12 cases, it is a tennis shoe or kind of a modern running shoe that has been found. So one of the theories that keeps coming up is because of how shoes are produced nowadays, particularly like with the Nike Air technology that started coming out in mid 80s into the 90s, that shoes are kind of acting as flotation devices for these human remains and bringing them to the surface where they eventually wind up on the beach. So I thought, well, if it's that common, I mean, look, these shoes are sold all over the world. Why do we have a number in this particular area that is reaching this? And I couldn't find, I found other instances of much smaller numbers, but I could not find anything in terms of a concentration that made sense, that would match up to this. This is by far the highest concentration in this particular area of feet being found.
Yeah, and why wouldn't it have been happening before 2007 if that were the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Those shoes have been around. I mean, we're talking decades that we've had this type of technology. So, it's a really good question, and it's still, despite the outcomes that I've heard, you know, you've had scientists look into this, you've had all kinds of opinions on this, it's still kind of unsettling to me. One of the theories is that there is a bridge close to this water source, and that people are committing suicide. They're actually jumping off that bridge. As they go into the water, eventually their ankles separate. And I learned more about this than I wanted to, but during the decomposition process, particularly in water, the ankles become what's called disarticulated. It's basically kind of a weak point in your body. And because the foot is in the shoe, that's staying pretty well protected, but the ankles will naturally separate, and the foot will remove itself from the rest of the body as it's decaying in water. So right. Bit of a reasonable explanation for why there's feet out there. But the interesting thing is the shoes bringing it to the surface. And then of the 12 shoes that were found, or of the 16 feet that were found, only two of them have been left feet.
Hmm.
14 of them are right feet. And there was even a theory about this that had to do with the curvature of the shoe on the right foot and the currents that are going through that area, and that the way that it's angled would push those shoes towards the shore faster than the left feet shoes, which is just another interesting weird science thing.
I would think that would need some like experiment to verify.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah. That would be a very interesting experiment. Throw a GPS tracker in a shoe and set that sucker off. Yeah. Do an even number of right shoes and left shoes, you know, drop them all from the same location, see where they wind up. Yeah, that'd be a really interesting one. Maybe some days if our channels get big enough, we can collaborate on something like that.
I totally forgot what I was just saying. Oh, how many of the bodies have been found along with the shoes? Any?
You know, we could go, Wikipedia has a really good article on this where they actually tag every instance of the foot being found. We could literally go piece by piece if you want to, but, as far as I know, as far as I can remember, it's been a while since I shot this episode. No bodies were found. In one of the cases, a lower leg was attached to the shoe. So you had more than just the disarticulation from the ankle. You actually had the, you know, the lower part of the leg that came up with it. But in all the other cases, it's literally just the foot in a shoe. What's really interesting is there is one particular case, which was a boating accident. If I remember right, it was from 1987. And we're not talking about a sports type shoe in this case. He was wearing a boot, and that was found in this collage of feet that have been found as well. And when you're thinking about human remains being in the ocean since 1987,
yeah,
coming up in the mid 2000s, you know, that at least is supporting the theory that the shoe is doing a significant amount of protection of the item that is in it.
Of course, that's a boot too, so it's going to have a little more protection than your average sneaker.
Yeah, yeah, and you really have to think you're trying to keep the elements of the sea, in particular creatures, from eating, you know, what's in there. So it's yeah, it just seems like kind of the perfect coincidence to pull all this together.
Well, how many of the feet have been identified?
They have identified a lot of them. I don't know if I have an exact stat on that. But they started doing some interesting thing. They took DNA from all of them. So they've been tracking that. There was a plane crash that happened in the area, and they thought, well, this, I think it was only five people that were in the plane. It was a small plane. They were thinking, you know, these feet probably belong to the bodies of the people that crashed in that flight. They've been doing DNA analysis, and it has not matched bodies from that flight.
Hmm.
So, but in many of the cases over the course of, I mean, years, and they've really been working really hard on these cases. They have identified, I believe it's eight, if I remember correctly. And in both of the cases where there was left feet, they found the matching right feet as well.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm. Did they know, were the eight people that they were able to identify, did they know what happened to them?
Yeah, there's a little bit of, well, one of them is the guy from 1987. They,
right.
They knew that he was in an accident of a boating accident of some kind. In many of these cases, they seem to be going back to the reason that perhaps they had killed themselves. Some of the cases you'll see the person was suffering from depression. Their family was already kind of worried about them. Mm. A few are listed as natural causes. There's only one case in particular, if I remember right, where it looked like the ankle was actually cut, where it didn't naturally disarticulate. So of all these cases, I believe there's only one where they thought there might have been something potentially foul play related going on with it.
Hmm. So after looking at this, do you think that that's viable, that these are not, that these are likely suicides?
You know, it's certainly a possibility, but, you know, I used to live in California and, you know, there's plenty of bridges there.
Right.
We don't hear about all the shoes that are showing up on Alcatraz or in the San Francisco Bay. I think it's, unfortunately, it sometimes seems like it's a default position for investigations, particularly when I'm looking into true crime issues. I will frequently see cases where I'm like, why did they come to that conclusion that, you know, this person did something to themselves?
Mm-hmm.
There's other things that could be looked at there. How do you know for sure? It's really tough for me to give you a clear answer on that. I think you really have to go case by case and look into each case individually and see if there's information to support that. Like we were talking about, if the family knew that this person was depressed, if they were struggling in their personal life leading up to their disappearance. I don't know. I think the thing that's strange about this case is really the location being such a relatively small area, and
yeah,
so many instances of this same thing happening there over and over. So there clearly has to be something, in my mind, regionalized to that area that's going on.
Yeah, and that's just so weird.
Yeah.
And again, only since a certain time period. So, like, what happened between then and now that's causing feet to wash up in just this one spot?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And there was even a couple cases where people started doing hoaxes once this started kicking up. Mm. And there was press that was going on with this. There was one instance where someone took a skeletonized animal paw, put it in a sock, and then put it in a shoe, and then stuffed it with dry seaweed and left it on a beach for people to find.
Mm.
I've heard other instances, raw meat was used in some cases. So not only do you have a very interesting phenomenon going on there, you've got, you know, pranksters trying to get some attention out of it as well.
Well, of course. Or even not just get attention, but it also kind of, it makes people doubt that there's something going on more, because they'll hear that, oh, this was fake. And well, maybe some of the other ones were fake too.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Kind of discredits it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is just such a strange thing.
It is. It really, really is. Definitely made for a fun episode. And if you want to go into each individual case with me, just come on over to Lord and Art's channel on YouTube and do a search for the Floating Feet Mystery on Brain Scratch.
And there's been nothing updated since you did your episode.
No recent updates on it. It seems like they do have a discovery maybe once every couple years. The most recent one was found February 12th of 2016. So I don't think it's necessarily over, especially if we're talking about some type of regional problem that's going on there. If people are killing themselves off of some particular bridge that's leading them into this water source, unless they're going to try to address it, you know, put some cameras on the bridge, have some type of, you know, police monitoring it or something along those lines. I think that we will probably see these things continue. But so far for 2017, none reported.
And that's a good question. Why haven't they just thrown a simple camera on the bridge?
Yeah. Yeah. If you've pinpointed it down to that, I think that's really something that you want to look into. And I have heard of in other parts of the world, in other cases that I've looked into, that when they find a particular area, if it seems like people are either falling or jumping to their deaths, they have added camera systems to those locations. Just seems kind of reasonable, if nothing else, to speed up the investigation once a body part is found. At least they could, you know, go back and trace it to who it is.
Yeah, and I mean, cameras are not expensive.
No, and it's really, that could almost be its own episode. It's pretty interesting if you look into the culture and the differences between, particularly between here and the United Kingdom. There is a show on Netflix. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it's particularly about workers in the United Kingdom that monitor their cameras. And they have just an amazing amount of cameras. They're literally busting people that are like, peeing on a wall. Like two seconds later, a cop's walking up because one of their CCTV cameras caught it. But they're also getting into a really different level of crime. They'll have like shoplifters and stuff that they're catching on camera, and they're able to have police intercept them right on the spot. Mm-hmm. I know people look at that situation and they go, wow, that sounds a little 1984 for me, or, you know, how many cameras do I need to feel safe when I'm in a public place? But if you watch that show and see some of the interactions, it's pretty interesting to me to see the level of crime that they're able to address when they have that type of information, where I think about someone out here shoplifting, you know, like in Minneapolis or something like that. You're probably going to be able to get away with it for a while before you get caught and not be, you know, caught within minutes of you leaving the store.
Yeah. Yeah. But there is that fine edge, like too much and what's invading people's privacy to what degree, and how that information gets used in the future.
Yeah, and there's also infrastructure. I mean, in the UK, they have officers that are literally sitting and watching these, you know, all these different screens looking for what's going on and trying to catch this stuff and then notify the officers that are on the ground. So, increased police costs, no doubt. The infrastructure of maintaining all those cameras, what happens when they go down, there's certainly costs associated with all that.
Yeah. But to throw a couple cameras on this bridge, if you think everyone is jumping from it, you know, or if a decent number of people are jumping from it, prove it right or prove it wrong right there.
Yeah. Do a motion detected camera system on there.
And, if you find someone jumping off the bridge and you find their foot later, well, then there you go.
Right, right.
But like you said, they thought the airplane going down would have been connected to these feet, but it wasn't.
No, and that's just this at the start of the investigation. And luckily, with the occurrences still happening over and over, and all the press that was buzzing around this, it's like the RCMP felt like they had to address this. So they really kept working at trying to crack this case and all these cases. I mean, each one is its own thing.
And of course, it has its own paranormal theories addressed to it as well.
Doesn't everything?
Pretty much.
About the only thing I didn't hear was that aliens don't like the taste of feet.
I think you just cracked it.
Right.
Well, let's. One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about tonight was the disappearance of what is his name?
Brian Schaefer.
Brian Schaefer. Yes. Now, I addressed this previously with David Politis, and one of my big questions for David was, you know, because he mentioned there were cameras on both entrances, I think.
Yeah, well, there's a camera on the entrance, and then there's also an emergency exit door that supposedly had a camera that was programmed so that when it opened, it would zoom in on whoever was coming out of that door.
And the most logical question I had for him is, were there any other exits? You know, I mean, something back room or, you know, service entrance, and he had no idea. I got a bunch of responses from people saying that they believed there was like an entrance that went to a parking garage or something like that, some kind of service entrance. It looks like you tried to look around as much as you could on this to find out.
Yeah. Just to give you a quick brief on it, Brian Schaefer, medical student at Ohio State University. This is back in 2006. He was just at the start of spring break. He had just crunched all week to get through some tests. Went out with his father, had dinner, told his father he was going out with a buddy of his. His father was wondering if it was a good idea for him to go out with his buddy or not because he just seemed so exhausted. But he did go out with that friend. They went bar hopping. They started at a place called the Ugly Tuna Saluna. They went to a couple of other bars, and then they went back to the Ugly Tuna Saluna, and that's where this went down. And really, the big mystery here is kind of how you paraphrased it. They have footage from the camera, and it's kind of hard to imagine, but it's like a mall area. So you have doors that you open, and you go up two escalators, or one escalator goes up, one escalator goes down. Then you get to where the front of the bar is. So the bar is actually inside of another building.
Right.
They have a camera in that spot that shows you the escalator. So they have footage of him coming up the escalator with his friends. Then he goes into the bar. A little bit later, they have footage of him talking to two girls outside of the bar. And then he steps out of frame. Now, when you typically hear this story retold, people seem to insist that when he steps out of frame, that means that he actually went back into the bar. This is happening at 1:55 at night. The bar is going to close at 2. Supposedly, the bar closes. His friends can't find him. They try to call him on his cell phone. They can't get to him, so they just go home. He only lives about 6 blocks away from this, 10-minute walk. He could have easily left on his own and gotten home. But the footage does not show him ever leaving the bar. So that is where this big mystery is.
Yeah.
We have the other door, which is the emergency exit that I mentioned, supposedly automatically triggered to zoom in if someone goes out of that door. He's not seen on that door. There is also construction going on in this area. And apparently, he could have gotten out by going through the construction site. But investigators don't really believe that someone that had been drinking hard all night in the middle of the night in a construction zone, not well lit, would really be able to navigate that safely. The thing that I started wondering when I was looking into it was I wanted to understand this building more because the footage from the camera doesn't really show the bar entrance. It just shows the escalator. What I learned is the bar entrance is actually, if you're facing the camera, it's to the right. If you go to the left, it's actually the lobby for a movie theater.
Right.
There's also another bar that's kind of part of the movie theater that's over there. If you go straight in the direction where it looks like he's actually walking off, there's a hallway there. There is an office for the Ohio State University. Some department of theirs has a small office there. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head. And there's also two additional doors back there. So when I was looking at this and, you know, just looking at Google Maps, luckily they have a lot of cameras that you can walk all the way around the building.
Mm-hmm.
I was also wondering that. Is there like a hallway structure back there? I used to work in a couple places where they were mall-type buildings, and there was usually this kind of private hallway structure that was behind the buildings because that's how the deliveries would come in.
Right.
The loading docks for this whole building is all the way over at the other side of the building. So way on the exact opposite end of where this bar is. So I'm assuming when they get their beer and their, you know, their inventory restocked, someone's parking way over there and somehow getting to the bar, likely through some back systems. So it's one of those things where the simple story sure sounds fantastic. You know, we've got footage. We see him come in. We don't see him go out. Some people think his body's still in the bar. If you take a look online on Yelp and you see how many people complain about the smell of the bar, you actually, it might actually make you think twice about that realization. But police have investigated the bar. Police spoke to the two girls that he was speaking to. No one has any information on what happened to Brian. It's literally like the guy just disappeared at 1:55 as soon as he walks off that footage. But I am relatively fairly certain that there were other ways for him to get out. I feel pretty confident that he did not walk back into the bar. I mean, the bar was closing in 5 minutes. I mean, I guess he could have gone back in if he wanted to close his tab or meet back up with his friends or something like that. But the direction that he walks off in the camera is actually the hallway. And it's just a question of, do those doors in the hallway lead to other places where he might have been able to get out? Apparently, this was a favorite spot of his. You know, maybe he knew of some back door that would let him out on the other side of the street where it would shorten his walk home a little or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But then what happened to him? One of the main theories kicking around is apparently this part of town where this bar is pretty rough. It's kind of been going through a gentrification. And perhaps something happened to him on his walk home. I think that's a really good theory. I have heard from other people that there's some suspicion around this friend that he was with.
Right, right.
It's weird because I try to not report on this stuff too much on my channel when it comes into, you know, well, people are talking about this and people are talking about that. I mean, if it's theories, that's one thing. But when it comes to his friend Clint, there's stuff that I'm hearing around him about things that happened before this, where like maybe he set up Brian to be punched by someone. Maybe they weren't really as tight of friends as everyone is assuming. He might have been in Brian's apartment that same day for several hours before this happened. I don't know. I'm at the point right now where I'm starting to get a new influx of information. But like we were talking about at the top of this show, it needs to start with those stories, but we have to take it from those stories and see if we can find, you know, pieces physically that match up with that story that makes sense.
Now, wasn't part of the reason people were thinking he had something to do with it because he refused to take a lie detector and he...
Yes. Yeah, he did lawyer up and get a lie detector. And, you know, after looking into as much true crime as I have since Brain Scratch started, I used to think that that was very suspicious as well, but I've had enough conversations with viewers, and I don't know if it's quite as suspicious nowadays. Some people just don't believe in lie detectors, period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Other people have access to lawyers, and their lawyers are going to tell you, you know, don't say anything. So in this case, Clint did have a lawyer. I think he initially cooperated with police a little bit. But then once he spoke to his lawyer, he pretty much stopped talking to them. He won't take a lie detector. You know, it's possible. It's possible that he has something to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, lie detectors are by no means perfect. And if you fail a lie detector, then you really look guilty, even if you're not.
Yeah, yeah. And it's tough because there was a guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, who actually... He used to be an administrator of lie detector tests, and then he decided that he was going to start training people on how to be able to fool lie detector tests.
Mm.
He was charged, And he served 2 years in prison, I think.
what was he charged with?
They came after him. What was it for? There was something, it was something about how he phrased that he was going to help them like deceive the police or something like that. It wound up becoming a somewhat of a criminal act. And it was literally in the way that he was marketing this, come take a course and I'll teach you how to get out of things. And originally they were, I mean, he was facing like really steep charges, and he went in for, as far as I saw last, he was only going in for 2 years and then he was going to come back out. But he basically turned on it because he felt like the whole time that he was administrating those tests that they were junk, that you couldn't really trust the results from them.
Yeah. I remember with the Travis Walton case, you know, they wanted all those guys to take lie detector tests to prove that they didn't, you know, kill Travis. And, you know, they all passed but one, and the one guy was really nervous and really, you know, worried about taking a lie detector test. And of course the debunkers will focus in on that one and be like, well, he failed. And it's like, yeah, but all the other guys passed. Right. And I believe that guy passed when he took it again. You know, it's not foolproof. And if you're really nervous, you're probably going to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then of course you have Travis going on that show, right? What was the name of that show? He went on it was almost like a game show.
I don't know.
I can't remember it off the top of my head. I did an episode about Travis and I actually showed the footage in the episode. And the way the game show is set up is you're basically up against a lie detector. And they asked him specifically, was he abducted by aliens? And he failed on the show. Man, I can't remember.
I think I have heard of that.
Yeah, you can find it on YouTube. If you look up Travis Walton lie detector, I'm pretty sure that you'll find it really, really quickly on YouTube. There's many, many postings of that same video.
I'm sure. And I having met Travis and looked into his story, I don't think he was lying about what happened to him.
Right.
I don't necessarily believe it was aliens. I don't know what to believe of it. I mean, it's one of those things we just don't know. I mean, something happened to him, I believe, and I don't think it was any kind of foul play or anything. He may have encountered something that was plasma in nature, you know, some kind of anomaly that knocked him out and you know, disrupted him. He may have, there's any number of things that may have happened. To call it aliens, I think, is kind of a jump.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But as I've heard you talk about on your show before, yeah, it could be a matter of perception or perspective or something that he's going through. But you do have him, you know, he's disappearing.
Yeah.
And then he's coming back, which is a really interesting aspect to that whole story. I just looked it up. The show was called The Moment of Truth. So if you guys want to look up Travis Walton on The Moment of Truth, you'll see the clip that I'm talking about.
Nice. The case here with Brian, a lot of people also connected to the Smiley Face Killers, but unlike the Smiley Face Killers, he was never found. All the murders connected to the Smiley Face Killers are that way because they were found under like smiley face symbols.
Yeah. Yeah. You're basically saying precisely what I said, at the start of the episode when I went into this. And let me just say, I've been receiving requests to cover this particular case forever. And I did hear that David had looked into this and possibly tied it into some of his researches as well. Right. But the smiley face killer theory, which I'm certainly critical of, I have done a video series on that as well. The whole main condition of that is body being found in water and within a reasonable distance, usually 1 to 2 miles, some type of smiley face graffiti being found.
Right.
In this particular case, we just don't have that. I mean, yes, he's close to a water source. I think it's about a mile to a river that was running nearby there. They searched that river several times. I don't see this really connecting in a very strong way to that theory. I'm actually curious, did David mention the connections that he was seeing with this case to his research?
He was tying most of these cases into the wilderness disappearances.
Which once again is just kind of strange for me because he's not in the wilderness, when he goes missing. This is a very populated area. You've got literally people all around him. it's what makes it such a strong mystery is that there are so many witnesses. I can't believe that they didn't notice, that someone didn't notice, oh yeah, I saw this guy duck out a back door, or I saw this guy out on the balcony and he jumped over the balcony down onto the street below. But we don't have anyone that is speaking up on that.
Yeah.
And it's the level of tragedy that goes on here is really insane if you look at it from the perspective of his brother. He is one of two kids. About 3 weeks before he disappeared, his mother died of cancer.
Ugh.
So his brother literally loses their mother. Then his brother goes missing. Then his father, who was working really hard trying to find Brian and figure out what happened to him, he dies in September of 2008. There is a heavy windstorm in central Ohio. He's out in his yard clearing debris, and a branch blows off from a tree and fatally strikes him.
Wow.
So literally, Brian's brother is, you know, kind of left alone. I mean, all his family members really pass away in a really short period of time. Yeah. And his brother was supposed to go out with him that night.
Right. Didn't you say he felt guilty about that?
Yeah. He's feeling guilty about that. He had gone out to a comedy show with his, it's now his wife, but I believe it was his girlfriend at the time. The show ran late and he just didn't feel like, you know, dragging himself out to a college bar at that time of night. So he decided not to go.
And it doesn't mean he could have done anything anyway.
No. But, you know, another pair of eyes out there, someone that cared about Brian in particular might have noticed where he went or what he was doing. But yeah, I mean, really, what can you do at this point? We're talking about this case, you know, 11 years after the fact. I just hope his brother has been able to not blame himself too much. You know, I mean, you really can't look at situations like that and hold yourself accountable for the past in that way.
It's hard to let that go, though.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, well, what if? Or not to say, what if, you know?
Yeah, it certainly can be, for sure.
I mean, he clearly didn't do anything wrong. It's not like he, you know,
did
something that wrong, you know, ethically wrong or something that caused his brother to disappear. I mean, he just didn't feel like going out. That's not, no one should be blaming him for that, including himself.
Yeah, it's very true.
Now, when David Politis looked at this, he was connecting almost all these urban disappearances to the wilderness disappearances just based on more or less like, you know, being found near sources of water, bodies being found where people had previously searched for them, and some of the other criteria, not all the criteria that he found in the wilderness disappearances, but a handful of them.
Yeah.
And personally, I considered it. I looked at it. He made a good case for it, but I don't think they're connected. I think you're looking at, I think whatever the behind what's called the smiley face killers, I think is a very human thing. Whereas the wilderness disappearances, I'm not really sure what's behind it.
Right. Yeah. I've been somewhat critical of some information from David. I haven't really dove into his books. I literally had a viewer send me one of his books. I'm holding it right now, looking at it. Mm. But I did watch the movie that he just released.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a pretty well-constructed film. Unfortunately, I think he featured, the majority of the film was about a case where I'm not sure that something supernatural is happening, kind of the same way that you were talking about, the Dior Kunz case.
Right.
Which is, you know, a little boy goes missing in the wilderness, but you've got two private eyes. And actually in the movie, they only featured one of them. There's two separate investigators that think that his parents are involved in some way in his disappearance.
Wow. I haven't actually seen the movie yet, but it seems like a lot of people are not particularly happy with it. I've gotten a lot of people telling me they were really disappointed. Mostly because it did only cover the one case.
It's tough because I was hoping that it would be a good entry point to me understanding more about his theory. But when if I remember right, there's five cases covered in total, but literally 90% of the film is talking about Dior's case. And then the other cases are given very, very brief information. So I didn't come out of it feeling like, oh, okay, now I understand what this guy's trying to say. And, you know, I feel like going and buying one of his books and jumping into this. Yeah. I came out of it going, wow, you know, I looked into Dior's case myself. I have been in contact with one of the private investigators on that case that used to work for the family that now thinks that they're involved. I don't think that that case is necessarily the type of mystery that is tying into the rest of this theory of some type of supernatural phenomenon happening out in the wilderness. But I do have to say that for the information that was there, I thought they did a good job presenting it. I thought there was, you know, good photography, great interviews. You know, I kind of enjoyed it. I was really looking for some type of core message that I could get a better understanding of David's, you know, point of view.
Yeah, which is, I thought, what he was going for, so I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really not sure, but now I'm going to crack into one of his books and see if I get it from there.
my guess is that there's a number of things going on. Even though he's finding patterns, there's many of the cases probably have very prosaic explanations. We just don't have all the information. Someone had actually made an interesting point. One of the weirder things that David had discovered are cases where, you know, you have a pile of bones and then, like, say, the belt is folded up nicely next to the remains.
Right.
Or something like that. And you think, well, that's odd. Why would that, you know, why would that be the case? And someone had suggested, well, maybe someone found the remains and as a matter of respect, just kind of folded up their belt and left it there. And it's like, well, that's a possibility.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah. It
still seems like you would have then contacted the police, even if you did that. But then the police would have shown up and been like, well, why is the belt all rolled up? You know?
Well, and that is one of those things where some people might, you know, like someone like you or me, I think, yeah, we would absolutely contact the authorities and get them in there. But depending on what type of person you are, you know, if you were out there drunk or doing drugs or doing something illegal, didn't want someone to find that your prints were now on this belt, were worried about being implicated in some way, just fearful of the police in general. I mean, there's all kinds of different people that would react different in that situation.
True. That's a very good point. I mean, there are definitely cases he has that are very strange. And when I had him on, I always tried to focus on those because I figured those had the most, you know, I went for the ones that were most likely strange versus the ones that were, okay, that's a little odd, but it may just be lack of information on our part.
Right.
Because in some of the cases are so old, it's hard to dig back into them.
Yeah, I definitely saw that trend in the film. There was a couple of cases where they were pretty old. And in one of the cases, the person actually survived and was found. So I really wasn't sure how he was part of any overall, you know, conspiracy or paranormal theory.
Well, there are cases, and some of the people who are, a lot of times when people are found, they don't remember where they've been.
And I think he was really young and yeah, he didn't have a good recollection of what had happened to him.
And the handful of people who do, you know, like there was one woman who said that she had wandered off the trail and she saw strange people and she kept trying to talk to them and they would just like ignore her like she wasn't there. And she saw other people hiding behind trees and stuff like that. And she didn't know what was going on. And eventually she was not familiar with, I guess she thought she knew where she was and found herself someplace else and then eventually found her way out. And she was like, I don't know who those people were or why they were behaving like that, you know? Yeah. And it's kind of like, okay, that's a little weird.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. You have some kind of cult going on out there.
Right. Or, you know, you have the people who had wandered off. They were walking their property and suddenly found themselves somewhere they didn't recognize.
Yeah.
When they didn't return, their father went out and he's yelling for them and they never heard him. And they suddenly, you know, just wandering randomly, suddenly recognized where they were. And then they could hear their father again, which makes you think, was there something weird going on where they shifted out of this reality just a little bit?
Right. Right.
If that's a thing, I mean, that's what it sounds like when you hear their description of how they just were walking somewhere they were very familiar with and suddenly they had no idea where they were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are tales in fairy lore like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's impossible to prove.
Right.
Because again, you just have their story.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they were out doing drugs and then they didn't want to hear their dad.
Right. That can certainly change your perception.
But yeah, there are some people who have come back from these cases who disappeared strangely and came back in weird circumstances.
Yeah.
So it's not just that they disappear completely. Sometimes they're found alive and they have no idea where they've been. Kids who, even some of the corpses that are found to some of these people will have traveled large distances, have no shoes on, and not be particularly injured from the travel.
Right, right.
Which suggests they did not walk that whole way.
Yeah, yeah. Those are really interesting cases. I always get more caught up in cases where there's some type of tape. That's really something that I look for when there's cases that I'm reviewing. And I know David had covered the case of Henry McCabe, which is actually out here in Minnesota where I live. And one of the first things I did when I got out here, I moved out here just a little over a year ago now, is I did an episode on that case, but I actually went to the scenes where he was the night that he disappeared. And did, you know, just kind of retraced his footsteps a little bit. And then he was found in a water source, but he had left a very disturbing voicemail on his wife's phone. And I heard David interviewed speaking about that voicemail. The thing that's really bizarre about the voicemail is it sounds like Henry is almost turning into a monster, or there's a monster around him. I mean, there's literally growling and screaming that is happening in the voicemail.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah. Now, since it's strange because I'd only heard that same audio clip over and over, and it's very compelling when you hear that audio clip in that way. I went looking everywhere I could and could not find the original unedited version of that tape. Eventually, I was contacted by someone and provided a copy of the unedited tape. And it is much different to hear the unedited version. I haven't.
Really?
Yeah, I don't have what I feel is like the appropriate permission to rebroadcast it, or I would certainly have it on my channel.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, Henry is speaking normally for most of it. And then he almost ramps up into this frenzy, almost like if you were getting sick, like if your stomach was really hurting and you kind of start groaning. And then he kind of comes back down and he's speaking normally again. And then it's like he's clenching up again and all of a sudden making these very bizarre noises to the point where he's yelling. So it gives you a much different perspective than, you know, all the news coverage that you saw on it, where they basically clipped out all of the normal talking and took these two pieces of tape where he is groaning and screaming and knocked them together like it's all happening at once.
You know, of course they did.
Right.
That makes it seem that much stranger. I mean, it's still strange.
It's very strange. And to know more about that case, you know, to understand what he's talking about, because he has a very strong accent. It's really hard to make out what he's saying during the times where he's speaking somewhat normally. That's kind of where the mystery is for me. I would love to know more about what he's saying in those cases, but I don't know. I think I'm gonna have to try to reach out to his wife and see if I can get her help with that possibly. But that's always a fine line. I much prefer when people, particularly family members of victims or missing persons cases, when they come to me. I really don't want to upset people by, you know, contacting them. Hey, I'm this guy on YouTube and I got a bunch of questions for you.
Yeah. A lot of times they don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah.
I had another question about Brian Schaefer, but I don't remember what it was now. Has anyone been able to clarify further from when you broadcast that? I mean, you did say the hallway was there. Is that something that a listener brought up to you?
Yeah, I had asked people in my video, and this is, once again, one of the things I love about the YouTube format and about having that right to be wrong thing that I talked about earlier. I was very clear with them. I did not have a clear understanding of what was inside that building, but it looked to me like there was numerous businesses, which meant many other avenues for him to possibly, you know, slip out of the building in some other way. So my viewers, my wonderful viewers, started sending me information. They found other images that Google had hosted of the interior of the building where you could see where the actual bar opening was. You could see that hallway. I had viewers that live in the area that told me about what that building's like, what the area was like at the time. It's amazing. I love my brain scratchers.
What is the police's statement on all that?
I think that they have been pretty tight-lipped on it. I'm not really aware of what their current status on that would be. I know some of the footage that I reviewed of it was their investigators talking about the case kind of back when it was happening. And they were really just kind of puzzled about that footage. I mean, it really does leave you with a very hard question of how the heck did he get out of that building? Even if he did some type of backdoor exit, like I was mentioning, then the question becomes why, you know,
right.
I mean, why wouldn't he just go down the escalator? Like literally every other person that went to the bar did. Was there something else going on? Was one of his friends potentially saying, "Hey, come out here, for some reason we need to talk," something along those lines. I just don't know.
Or did he wander down that hallway and see saying he wasn't supposed to?
Possible. It's possible. You never know. I really struggle with the thought that it happened in the building, that something would have happened to him. I feel like the angle on him getting out of the building and then potentially walking home, something happening to him on the way there. As a matter of fact, I know his family even heard from someone, and you know, when you become a public figure for being in that type of situation, you can get a lot of crackpots that send you information.
Sure.
I know that the family did hear from someone that Brian was attacked by a bunch of men and that they were, messing around with his skull and that they, you know, hit him in a trash can somewhere. The family just heard horrible things. But
yeah,
there's something to that theory that just kind of resonates with me in terms of the reality of what's going on and the possibility that something could have happened to him. There was another strange twist that his apartment was broken into just 1 or 2 months after he went missing. But it seems like they only took small electronics. So it kind of seems like it's a random thing. Some people have told me that perhaps there's something more to that. Like if it is someone that did something to him that was close to him, maybe there was something in the apartment they were looking for, or that they were afraid that other people were going to find and they wanted right. to get it out of there first. So
I know the other question I was going to ask you, as far as connecting it to the Smiley Face killers, is this an area where other people have been found in that type of way?
That's another tough aspect to the Smiley Face killer theory is, it doesn't seem to have strong regionalization. Pretty much any case that happens in the U.S., if it's close to a water source and there's a smiley face by it, they add that to the theory.
Okay.
So, regionalization does not seem to be a strong part of that theory. And in the video series I did on it, I really tried to call up a few major points. First of all, smiley face graffiti is extremely common. At the last place I lived, I kind of have this game now that when I live somewhere, I look for the nearest smiley face graffiti just to see how odd it is. Mm-hmm. When I was living in California, there was literally a giant smiley face burned into a hill that was only a few miles from where I lived.
Wow.
When I moved out here to Minnesota, I went for a walk in my new local neighborhood, and on a stop sign that was only 2 blocks from my house, there was smiley face graffiti. It's one of the most common, I mean, think about smiley faces, how often you see them. It's one of the most common symbols in humanity, I think. So there's that aspect, but then there's also the aspect of, young men drowning. And sometimes alcohol is involved. In a lot of these stories you hear about the smiley face, they're college age, young guys, they go out drinking, they disappear, usually from a bar, or they start walking home and then they disappear, and then they're found in a nearby water source. If you do some research on that, it is something that is strange, but there is a statistical, a thing you can actually research. Look at the Center for Disease Control, if I remember right. If you look up my episodes on this and look in the description box, you'll find all the links to all my research. And I actually found stats on those types of deaths. And they occur particularly with young men, particularly around water sources, at a much higher rate than women, like 80% higher.
Hmm. Well, I guess David presented it as them being in clusters, but also Steph Young had, when she wrote about it, she called it dead in the water because so many of them didn't drown.
Hmm.
You know, yeah. Because you had the same thing in Manchester in the UK and a few other places where the bodies were found, but it didn't seem like they drowned. It seemed like they were in the water after they died.
That's a really interesting aspect. Once again, I'd have to look at those case by case. Mm-hmm. I'd have to hopefully get my hand on an autopsy report to confirm that. It's tough when you have people reviewing that type of information and you have them look at an autopsy report and it says that there's fluid in the lungs, but then you have some people say, well, that's not enough. That couldn't have been that they drowned. Then you have to learn more about the decomposition process, particularly in water.
Yeah,
I find that these kind of quick, what you would think are logical judgments and understandings of what go on can be challenged very quickly by research into the science of what's going on.
Okay. Fair enough.
But it's just, it's a matter of how deep you're going to dive. You know, if I myself am trying to, I don't know, monetize myself in some way because I want to write a series of books or do a movie or something like that, is it really going to benefit me to look at things that deeply and truly come to an understanding that maybe these things aren't quite that odd? Or am I going to say, you know what, I've got a deadline, my publisher wants this thing done, I need to get something on the page and I'm going to do the research to get to that point and then stop. It's just, I think that's why I'm a bit different than a lot of my contemporaries on YouTube that are doing more of what I consider creepy storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I get a much, I don't know how to even phrase it right. I get a better feeling about what I'm doing by trying to expose the elements that I find to be true, that I can look at and say, look, we have this information over here that supports this thought. We have these people saying that this happened over on this side. We can join those two in the middle and say it's a pretty reasonable conclusion that we have here. When you look at other channels that do some of what I do, they're really not trying to do that. It's typically that those elements where things are mysterious are where their research stops. As soon as they get the version of the story where you have that kind of, just like with Brian Schaefer, the version of the story where there's no other way out of the bar.
Right.
And he wasn't seen on camera. Boom. Creepy. You know, but if you actually look into it more and you ask people to help you, like I did, all of a sudden you're getting pictures of different hallways and different doors all over the place. And no one even really, in the original research I was looking in, no one even really addressed the fact that he could have jumped off the open balcony, that there was a somewhat, I mean, not super reasonable, but there was a way that he could have gotten to the ground without hurting himself too badly.
And especially if he's been drinking and thinking, I could do this.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, it's also good that you take on these things case by case and do delve as deeply as you do into it. Because you're right. A lot of people don't have the time or resources to spend on just one case. So they have to go with what's popularly out there.
Yeah. And you know, that's why I have like a little bit of a love and hate thing with Wikipedia. I consider Wikipedia to be a really good resource, but in particular, it's for finding the popular version of that story.
Yes.
You know, when you consider how it works, you have multiple people writing into this article. It's going to be the most popular version that you wind up with there. That doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be the most factually accurate, which I've found in several articles where, you know, literally years are wrong, dates are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is a good way to start looking into something. And from there, it's really just how much time do you have? How deep can you dive? And how far do you want to go?
Well, and the thing about Wikipedia is, you know, people like to down with Wikipedia, but everything is supposed to be notated. So you can see where the source is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Which once again gets a little questionable depending on those sources. You know, I mean, nowadays I'm seeing notations like for podcasts and stuff like that as being sources, which not to knock podcasts, but I wouldn't want Brain Scratch, my own show, to be a source on Wikipedia. I'd rather that they used my show to say, oh, wait, he looked at this news article where this person is quoted as saying that, and then pull that as the source over to Wikipedia.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's once again, just a question of almost information fidelity. Just, you know, what sources are you going to trust? How far are you going to dig in? I mean, in particular, when I'm doing missing persons cases, I'm literally reading about every publicly posted news story in particular, to try to get a good sense of where the truth is in that. Because even from article to article, you're going to see discrepancies all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to try to figure out, okay, which one am I going to trust more? Or you don't. You just tell your audience, hey, on this side, they're saying it's this. On that side, they're saying it's that. I don't know which one to believe, but we have a discrepancy in this info. So just keep that in mind as we go forward. And I still think that that is a stronger position for having those conversations rather than just, you know, going with the bigger news article because it came from your favorite, you know, CNN or Fox or whatever you trust.
Absolutely. Real quick, before I let you go, have there been any updates in the last year on the Elisa Lam case?
Not updates in the case in particular. The hotel has been bought by someone. It's been closed. He is redeveloping it right now. So there's a bunch of construction that's going on in there. I'm curious to see how much they're going to change the entryway because that's kind of what was most recognizable about it and what most people thought was the nicest thing about it, including Elisa. But around all that, you know, there is a documentary that was kickstarted. They asked me to help with that, so I helped promote it a little bit. We're trying to schedule some time together so I can go and shoot with them a little bit. So yeah, the Kickstarter documentary's coming. I've had a little bit of interest from a couple of television production companies kind of sniffing around it. I don't know if any of those things are going to pan out or not, but at this point I'd say there's kind of four projects based on Elisa that are kind of buzzing around me. But the one that I feel is on a track to certainly come is the kickstarted one. I mean, the money's in place. Jake Anderson from Ghost Diaries is working on it. He's been in contact with me regularly, even before this thing turned into a Kickstarter for a documentary. So I know it's something that he's really staying on top of, and I'm pretty confident that we will see his take on this whole mystery come out soon.
Nice. All right, where can people find you?
You can find me on YouTube. The channel's name is Lorden Arts. That's like Jordan, but with an L. You can also find me at LordenArts.com or on Twitter at LordenArts.
And do you have a Patreon?
I do, and links to that is available at LordenArts.com, or if you go into the description box of any video at the very bottom below all my sources, you will see a link for a Patreon there.
Awesome. Thank you so much for spending time with us, John.
Yeah, good talking to you again, Soraya. We'll have to do this again soon.
All right. Again, check out John's YouTube at Lorden Arts. And we're going to take you out with something from Eden Cantu. And that's E-D-E-N. Let me say that slower. C-A-N-T-U. This is the track called Away. See you next time. Thank you.
things bump in the night and into the day. Mysterious rides to our loved ones' dismay. There's dimensional ways of being whisked away. Stick drive, a cloud becomes